The Ship Who Sang by Anne McCaffrey. She was born a thing, and as such would be condemned if she failed to pass the encephalograph test required of all newborn babies. There was always the possibility that though the limbs were twisted, the mind was not. That though the ears would hear only dimly, the eyes see vaguely, the mind behind them was receptive and alert. The electroencephalogram was entirely favorable, unexpectedly so, and the news was brought to the waiting, grieving parents. There was the final harsh decision: to give their child euthanasia, or permit it to become an encapsulated brain, a guiding mechanism in any one of a number of curious professions. As such, their offspring would suffer no pain, live a comfortable existence in a metal shell for several centuries, performing unusual service to central worlds. She lived, and was given a name: Helva. For her first 3 vegetable months, she waved her crabbed claws, kicked weakly with her clubbed feet, and enjoyed the usual routine of the infant. She was not alone, for there were 3 other such children in the big city's special nursery. Soon they all were removed to Central Laboratory School, where their delicate transformation began. One of the babies died in the initial transferal, but of Helva's class, 17 thrived in the metal shells. Instead of kicking feet, Helva's neural responses started her wheels. Instead of grabbing with hands, she manipulated mechanical extensions. As she matured, more and more neural synapses would be adjusted to operate other mechanisms that went into the maintenance and running of a spaceship. For Helva was destined to be the brain half of a scout ship, partnered with a man or a woman, whichever she chose, as the mobile half. She would be among the elite of her kind. Her initial intelligence tests registered above normal, and her adaptation index was unusually high. As long as her development within her shell lived up to expectations, and there were no side effects from the pituitary tinkering, Helva would live a rewarding, rich, and unusual life, a far cry from what she would have faced as an ordinary, normal being. However, no diagram of her brain patterns, no early IQ tests recorded certain essential facts about Helva that Central must eventually learn. They would have to bide their official time and see, trusting that the massive doses of shell psychology would suffice her too as the necessary bulwark against her unusual confinement and the pressures of her profession. A ship run by a human brain could not run rogue or insane with the power and resources Central had to build into their scout ships. Brain ships were, of course, long past the experimental stages. Most babies survived the techniques of pituitary manipulation that kept their bodies small, eliminating the necessity of transfers from smaller to larger shells, and very, very few were lost when the final connection was made to the control panels of the ship or industrial combine. Shell people resembled mature dwarfs in size, whatever their natal deformities were, but the well-oriented brain would not have changed places with the most perfect body in the universe. So, for happy years, Helva scooted around in her shell with her classmates, playing such games as stall, power seek, studying her lessons in trajectory, propulsion techniques, computation, logistics, mental hygiene, basic alien psychology, philology, space history, law, traffic, codes, all the etceteras that eventually became compounded into a reasoning, logical, informed citizen. Not so obvious to her, but of more importance to her teachers. Helva ingested the precepts of her conditioning as easily as she absorbed her nutrient fluid. She would one day be grateful to the patient drone of the subconscious level instruction. Helva's civilization was not without busy do-good associations, exploring possible inhumanities to terrestrial as well as extraterrestrial citizens. One such group got all incensed over shelled children when Helva was just turning 14. When they were forced to, Central Worlds shrugged its shoulders, arranged a tour of the laboratory schools, and set the tour off to a big start by showing the members case histories, complete with photographs. Very few committees ever looked past the first few photos. Most of their original objections about shells were overridden by the relief that these hideous, to them, bodies were mercifully concealed. Helva's class was doing fine arts, a selective subject in her crowded program. She had activated one of her microscopic tools, which she would later use for minute repairs to various parts of her control panel. Her subject was large, a copy of The Last Supper, and her canvas, small, the head of a tiny screw. She had tuned her sight to the proper degree. As she worked, she absent-mindedly crooned, producing a curious sound. Shell people used their own vocal cords and diaphragms, but sound issued through speakers rather than mouths. Helva's hum, then, had a curious vibrancy, a warm, dulcet quality, even in its aimless chromatic wanderings. "Why, what a lovely voice you have," said one of the female visitors. Helva looked up and caught a fascinating panorama of regular dirty craters on a flaky pink surface. Her hum became a gurgle of surprise. She instinctively regulated her sight until the skin lost its cratered look and the pores assumed normal proportions. "Yes, we have quite a few years of voice training, madam," remarked Helva calmly. "Vocal peculiarities often become excessively irritating during prolonged interstellar distances and must be eliminated. I enjoyed my lessons." Although this was the first time that Helva had seen unshelled people, she took this experience calmly. Any other reaction would have been reported instantly. "I meant that you have a nice singing voice, dear," the lady amended. "Thank you. Would you like to see my work?" Helva asked politely. She instinctively sheered away from personal discussions, but she filed the comment away for further meditation. "Work?" asked the lady. "I am currently reproducing The Last Supper on the head of a screw." "Oh, I say," the lady twittered. Helva turned her vision back to magnification and surveyed her copy critically. "Of course, some of my color values do not match the old master's, and the perspective is faulty, but I believe it to be a fair copy." The lady's eyes, unmagnified, bugged out. "Oh, I forget." And Helva's voice was really contrite. If she could have blushed, she would have. "You people don't have adjustable vision." The monitor of this discourse grinned with pride and amusement as Helva's tone indicated pity for the unfortunate. "Here, this will help," suggested Helva, substituting a magnifying device in one extension and holding it over the picture. In a kind of shock, the ladies and gentlemen of the committee bent to observe the incredibly copied and brilliantly executed Last Supper on the head of a screw.
"Well," remarked one gentleman, who had been forced to accompany his wife, "the good Lord can eat where angels fear to tread."
"Are you referring, sir," asked Helva politely, "to the Dark Age discussion of the number of angels who could stand on the head of a pin?"
"Well, I had that in mind."
"If you substitute atom for angel, the problem is not insoluble, given the metallic content of the pin in question."
"Which you are programmed to compute?"
"Of course."
"Did they remember to program a sense of humor as well, young lady?"
"We are directed to develop a sense of proportion, sir, which contributes the same effect." The good man chortled appreciatively and decided the trip was worth his time. If the investigation committee spent months digesting the thoughtful food served them at the laboratory school, they left Helva with a morsel as well. Singing, as applicable to herself, required research. She had, of course, been exposed to and enjoyed a music appreciation course which had included the better-known classical works, such as Tristan and Isolde, Candide, Oklahoma, Nozze di Figaro, The Atomic Age Singers, Eileen Farrell, Elvis Presley, and Geraldine Todd, as well as the curious rhythmic progressions of the Venusians, Capellan visual chromatics, and the sonic concerti of the Altarians. But singing, for any shell person, posed considerable technical difficulties to be overcome. Shell people were schooled to examine every aspect of a problem or situation before making a prognosis. Balanced properly between optimism and practicality, the non-defeatist attitude of the shell people led them to extricate themselves, their ships and personnel, from bizarre situations. Therefore, to Helva, the problem that she couldn't open her mouth to sing, among other restrictions, did not bother her. She would work out a method, bypassing her limitations, whereby she could sing. She approached the problem by investigating the methods of sound production through the centuries, human and instrumental. Her own sound production equipment was essentially more instrumental than vocal. Breath control and the proper enunciation of vowel sounds within the oral cavity
appeared to require the most development and practice. Shell people did not, strictly speaking, breathe. For their purposes, oxygen and other gases were not drawn from the surrounding atmosphere through the medium of lungs, but sustained artificially by solution in their shells. After experimentation, Helva discovered that she could manipulate her diaphragmic unit to sustain tone. By relaxing the throat muscles and expanding the oral cavity well into the frontal sinuses, she could direct the vowel sounds into the most felicitous position for proper reproduction through her throat microphone. She compared the results with tape recordings of modern singers and was not unpleased, although her own tapes had a peculiar quality about them, not at all unharmonious, merely unique. Acquiring a repertoire from the laboratory library was no problem to one trained to perfect recall. She found herself able to sing any role and any song which struck her fancy. It would not have occurred to her that it was curious for a female to sing bass, baritone, tenor, alto, mezzo, soprano, and coloratura as she pleased. It was, to Helva, only a matter of the correct reproduction and diaphragmic control required by the music attempted. If the authorities remarked on her curious avocation, they did so among themselves. Shell people were encouraged to develop a hobby so long as they maintained proficiency in their technical work. On the anniversary of her 16th year in her shell, Helva was unconditionally graduated and installed in her ship, the XH-834. Her permanent titanium shell was recessed behind an even more indestructible barrier in the central shaft of the scout ship. The neural, audio, visual, and sensory connections were made and sealed. Her extendables were diverted, connected, or augmented, and the final delicate beyond-description brain taps were completed while Helva remained anesthetically unaware of the proceedings. When she awoke, she was the ship. Her brain and intelligence controlled every function, from navigation to such loading as a scout ship of her class needed. She could take care of herself and her ambulatory half in any situation already recorded in the annals of Central Worlds, and any situation its most fertile minds could imagine. Her first actual flight, for she and her kind had made mock flights on dummy panels since she was 8, showed her complete mastery of the techniques of her profession. She was ready for her great adventures and the arrival of her mobile partner. There were 9 qualified scouts sitting around collecting base pay the day Helva was commissioned. There were several missions which demanded instant attention, but Helva had been of interest to several department heads in Central for some time, and each man was determined to have her assigned to his section. Consequently, no one had remembered to introduce Helva to the prospective partners. The ship always chose its own partner. Had there been another brain ship at the base at the moment, Helva would have been guided to make the first move. As it was, while Central wrangled among itself, Robert Tanner sneaked out of the pilot's barracks, out to the field and over to Helva's slim metal hull. "Hello? Anyone at home?" Tanner wisecracked. "Of course," replied Helva logically, activating her outside scanners. "Are you my partner?" she asked hopefully, as she recognized the Scout Service uniform. "All you have to do is ask," he retorted hopefully. "No one has come. I thought perhaps there were no partners available, and I've had no directives from Central." Even to herself, Helva sounded a little self-pitying, but the truth was she was lonely, sitting on the darkened field. Always she had had the company of other shells, and more recently technicians by the score. The sudden solitude had lost its momentary charm and become oppressive. "No directives from Central is scarcely a cause for regret, but there happened to be 8 other guys biting their fingernails to the quick, just waiting for an invitation to board you, you beautiful thing." Tanner was inside the central cabin as he said this, running appreciative fingers over her panel, the scout's gravity couch, poking his head into the cabins, the galley, the head, the pressured storage compartments. "Now, if you want to give Central a shove and do us a favor all in one, call up the barracks and let's have a ship-warming partner-picking party, hmm?" Helva chuckled to herself. He was so completely different from the occasional visitors or the various laboratory technicians she had encountered. He was so gay, so assured, and she was delighted by his suggestion of a partner-picking party. Certainly it was not against anything in her understanding of regulations. "CENCOM, this is XH-834. Connect me with Pilot Barracks."
"A visual?"
"Please." A picture of lounging men in various attitudes of boredom came on her screen. "This is XH-834. Would the unassigned scouts do me the favor of coming aboard?" Eight figures galvanized into action, grabbing pieces of wearing apparel, disengaging tape mechanisms, disentangling themselves from bedsheets and towels. Helva dissolved the connection while Tanner chuckled gleefully and settled down to await their arrival. Helva was engulfed in an unshell-like flurry of anticipation. No actress on her opening night could have been more apprehensive, fearful, or breathless. Unlike the actress, she could throw no hysterics, china objet d'art, or grease paint to relieve her tension. She could, of course, check her stores for edibles and drinks, which she did, serving Tanner from the virgin selection of her commissary. Scouts were colloquially known as brawns, as opposed to their ship, brains. They had to pass as rigorous a training program as the brains, and only the top 1% of each contributory world's highest scholars were admitted to Central World's Scout Training Program. Consequently, the eight young men who came pounding up the gantry into Helva's hospitable lock were unusually fine-looking, intelligent, well-coordinated, and adjusted young men looking forward to a slightly drunken evening, Helva permitting, and all quite willing to do each other dirt to get possession of her. Such a human invasion left Helva mentally breathless, a luxury she thoroughly enjoyed for the brief time she felt she should permit it. She sorted out the young men. Tanner's opportunism amused but did not specifically attract her. The blonde Nordson seemed too simple. Dark-haired Al Atpe had a kind of obstinacy with which she felt no compassion. Mirhanin's bitterness hinted an inner darkness she did not wish to lighten, although he made the biggest outward play for her attention. Hers was a curious courtship. This would be only the first of several marriages for her, for brawns retired after 75 years of service, or earlier if they were unlucky. Brains, their bodies safe from any deterioration, served 200 years and were then permitted to decide for themselves if they wished to continue. Helva had actually spoken to one shell person 322 years old. She had been so awed by the contact, she hadn't presumed to ask the personal questions she had wanted to. Her choice did not stand out from the others until Tanner started to sing a scout ditty, recounting the misadventures of the bold, dense, painfully inept Billy Brawn. An attempt at harmony resulted in cacophony, and Tanner wagged his arms wildly for silence. "What we need is a roaring good lead tenor. Jennin, besides palming aces, what do you sing?" "Sharp," Jennin replied, with easy good humor. "If a tenor is absolutely necessary, I'll attempt it," Helva volunteered. "My good woman," Tanner protested. "Sound your A," laughed Jennin. Into the stunned silence that followed, the rich, clear, high A, Jennin remarked quietly, "Such an A, Caruso would have given the rest of his notes to sing." It did not take them long to discover her full range. "All Tanner asked for was one roaring good lead tenor," Jennin complained jokingly, "and our sweet mistress supplies us an entire repertory company. The boy who gets this ship will go far, far, far."
"To the Horsehead Nebulae?" asked Nordson,
quoting an old central saw.
"To the Horsehead Nebulae and back, we shall make beautiful music," countered Helva, chuckling.
"Together," Jennin amended.
"Only you'd better make the music, and with my voice, I'd better listen."
"I rather imagined it would be I who listened," suggested Helva. Jennin executed a stately bow with an intricate flourish of his crush-brimmed hat. He directed his bow toward the central control pillar where Helva was. Her own personal preference crystallized at that precise moment, and for that particular reason, Jennin, alone of the men, had addressed his remarks directly at her physical presence, regardless of the fact that he knew she could pick up his image wherever he was in the ship, and regardless of the fact that her body was behind massive metal walls. Throughout their partnership, Jennin never failed to turn his head in her direction, no matter where he was in relation to her. In response to this personalization, Helva, at that moment and from then on, always spoke to Jennin only through her central mic, even though that was not always the most efficient method. Helva didn't know that she fell in love with Jennin that evening, as she had never been exposed to love or affection, only the drier cousins, respect and admiration, she could scarcely have recognized her reaction to the warmth of his personality and consideration. As a shell person, she considered herself remote from emotions largely connected with physical desires. "Well, Helva, it's been swell meeting you," said Tanner suddenly, as she and Jennan were arguing about the Baroque quality of "Come All Ye Sons of Art." "See you in space sometime, you lucky dog, Jennan. Thanks for the party, Helva."
"You don't have to go so soon," pleaded Helva, realizing belatedly that she and Jennan had been excluding the others.
"Best man won," Tanner said wryly. "Guess I'd better go get a tape on love ditties. May need 'em for the next ship if there are any more at home like you."
Helva and Jennan watched them leave, both a little confused.
"Perhaps Tanner's jumping to conclusions?" Jennan asked.
Helva regarded him as he slouched against the console, facing her shell directly. His arms were crossed on his chest, and the glass he held had been empty for some time. He was handsome. They all were. But his watchful eyes were unwary. His mouth assumed a smile easily. His voice, to which Helva was particularly drawn, was resonant, deep, and without unpleasant overtones or accent.
"Sleep on it, Helva. Call me in the morning if it's your op."
She called him at breakfast, after she had checked her choice through Central. Jennan moved his things aboard, received their joint commission, had his personality and experience file locked into her reviewer, gave her the coordinates of their first mission, and the XH-834 officially became the JH-834. Their first mission was a dull but necessary crash priority, medical got Helva, rushing a vaccine to a distant system plagued with a virulent spore disease. They had only to get to Spica as fast as possible. After the initial thrilling forward surge of her maximum speed, Helva realized her muscles were to be given less of a workout than her brawn on this tedious mission. But they did have plenty of time for exploring each other's personalities. Jennan, of course, knew what Helva was capable of as a ship and partner, just as she knew what she could expect from him. But these were only facts, and Helva looked forward eagerly to learning that human side of her partner, which could not be reduced to a series of symbols, nor could the give and take of two personalities be learned from a book. It has to be experienced.
"My father was a scout, too, or is that programmed?" began Jennan their third day out.
"Naturally."
"Unfair, you know. You've got all my family history, and I don't know one blamed thing about yours."
"I've never known either," Helva confided. "Until I read yours, it hadn't occurred to me that I must have one, too, someplace in Central's files."
Jennan snorted. "Shell psychology."
Helva laughed.
"Yes, and I'm even programmed against curiosity about it. You'd better be, too."
Jennan ordered a drink, slouched into the gravity couch opposite her, put his feet on the bumpers, turning himself idly from side to side on the gimbals.
"Helva, a made-up name?"
"With a Scandinavian sound."
"You aren't blonde," Jennan said positively.
"Well, then, there are dark Swedes
and blonde Turks, and this one's harem is limited to one."
"Your woman in Perda, yes. But you can comb the pleasure houses." Helva found herself aghast at the edge to her carefully trained voice.
"You know," Jennan interrupted her, deep in some thought of his own, "my father gave me the impression he was a lot more married to his ship, the Sylvia, than to my mother. I know I used to think Sylvia was my grandmother. She was a low number, so she must have been a great-great-grandmother at least. I used to talk to her for hours."
"Her registry?" asked Helva, unwitting of the jealousy for everyone and anyone who had shared his hours.
422. I think she's TS now. I ran into Tom Burgess once."
Jennan's father had died of a planetary disease, the vaccine for which his ship had used up in curing the local citizens.
"Tom said she'd got mighty tough and salty. You lose your sweetness, and I'll come back and haunt you, girl," Jennan threatened.
Helva laughed. He startled her by stamping up to the control panel, touching it with light, tender fingers.
"I wonder what you look like," he said softly, wistfully.
Helva had been briefed about this natural curiosity of scouts. She didn't know anything about herself, and neither of them ever would or could. Pick any form, shape and shade, and I'll be yours obliging, she countered, as training suggested. Iron Maiden, I fancied blondes with long tresses, and Jenin pantomimed Lady Godiva-like tresses. Since you're immolated in titanium, I'll call you Brunhilda, my dear, and he made his bow. With a chortle, Helva launched into the appropriate aria, just as Spica made contact.
What in hell's that yelling about? Who are you? And unless you're Central World's medical, go away. We've got a plague with no visiting privileges.
My ship is singing. We're the JH-834 of Worlds, and we've got your vaccine. What are our landing coordinates?
Your ship is singing?
The greatest soprano, alto, tenor, bass in organized space. Any request? The JH-834 delivered the vaccine, but no more arias, and received immediate orders to proceed to Leviticus 4. By the time they got there, Jenin found a reputation awaiting him and was forced to defend the 834's virgin honor. I'll stop singing, murmured Helva contritely, as she ordered up poultices for this third black eye in a week.
You will not, Jenin said through gritted teeth. If I have to black eyes from here to the horse head to keep the snicker out of the title, we'll be the ship who sings.
After the ship who sings, tangled with a minor but vicious narcotic ring in the lesser Magellanics, the title became definitely respectful. Central was aware of each episode and punched out a special interest key on JH-834's file. A first-rate team was shaking down well. Jenin and Helva considered themselves a first-rate team, too, after their tidy arrest. Of all the vices in the universe, I hate drug addiction, Jenin remarked as they headed back to Central Base. People can go to hell quick enough without that kind of help.
Is that why you volunteered for scout service? To redirect traffic?
I'll bet my official answer's on your review.
In far too flowery wording. Carrying on the traditions of my family, which has been proud of 4 generations in service, if I may quote you your own words.
Jenin groaned.
I was very young when I wrote that, and I certainly hadn't been through final training. And once I was in final training, my pride wouldn't let me fail. As I mentioned, I used to visit Dad on board the Sylvia, and I've a very good idea she might have had her eye on me as a replacement for my father, because I had had massive doses of scout-oriented propaganda. It took. From the time I was 7, I was going to be a scout or else.
He shrugged as if deprecating a youthful determination that had taken a great deal of mature application to bring to fruition.
Ah, so. Scout Sahir Silan, on the JS-422, penetrating into the Horsehead Nebulae?
Jenin chose to ignore her sarcasm. With you, I may even get that far. But even with Sylvia's nudging, I never daydreamed myself that kind of glory in my wildest flights of fancy. I'll leave the whoppers to your agile brain henceforth. I have in mind a smaller contribution to space history.
So modest?
No, practical. We also serve, etc.
He placed a dramatic hand on his heart.
Glory hound, scoffed Helva.
Look who's talking, my nebulae-bound friend. At least I'm not greedy. There'll only be one hero like my dad at Parcia, but I would like to be remembered for some kudo. Everyone does. Why else do or die?
Your father died on his way back from Parcia, if I may point out a few cogent facts. So he could never have known he was a hero for damming the flood with his ship, which kept the Parcian colony from being abandoned, which gave them a chance to discover the antiparalytic qualities of Parcia, which he never knew.
I know, said Jenin softly. Helva was immediately sorry for the tone of her rebuttal. She knew very well how deep Jenin's attachment to his father had been. On his review, a note was made that he had rationalized his father's loss with the unexpected and welcome outcome of the affair at Parcia.
Facts are not human, Helva. My father was, and so am I. And basically, so are you. Check over your dial, 834. Amid all the wires attached to you is a heart. An underdeveloped human heart. Obviously.
"I apologize, Jenin," she said contritely. Jenin hesitated a moment, threw out his hands in acceptance, and then tapped her shell affectionately.
"If they ever take us off the milk runs, we'll make a stab at the nebulae, huh?"
As so frequently happened in the scout service, within the next hour they had orders to change course. Not to the nebulae, but to a recently colonized system with two habitable planets, one tropical, one glacial. The sun, named Ravel, had become unstable. The spectrum was that of a rapidly expanding shell, with absorption lines rapidly displacing toward violet. The augmented heat of the primary had already forced evacuation of the nearer world, Daphnis. The pattern of spectral emissions gave indication that the sun would sear Chloe as well. All ships in the vicinity were to report to disaster headquarters on Chloe to effect removal of the remaining colonists. The JH-834 obediently presented itself and was sent to outlying areas on Chloe to pick up scattered settlers who did not appear to appreciate the urgency of the situation. Chloe, indeed, was enjoying the first temperatures above freezing since it had been flung out of its parent. Since many of the colonists were religious fanatics who had settled on rigorous Chloe to fit themselves for a life of pious reflection, Chloe's abrupt thaw was attributed to sources other than a rampaging sun. Jenin had to spend so much time countering specious arguments that he and Helva were behind schedule on their way to the fourth and last settlement. Helva jumped over the high range of jagged peaks that surrounded and sheltered the valley from the former raging snows as well as the present heat. The violent sun with its flaring corona was just beginning to brighten the deep valley. "They'd better grab their toothbrushes and hop aboard," Helva commented. "HQ says speed it up."
"All women," remarked Jenin in surprise as he walked down to meet them. "Unless the men on Chloe wear furred skirts."
"Charm 'em, but pair the routine to bare essentials and turn on your two-way private." Jenin advanced, smiling, but his explanation was met with absolute incredulity and considerable doubt as to his authenticity. He groaned inwardly as the matriarch paraphrased previous explanations of the warming sun.
"Revered Mother, there's been an overload on that prayer circuit, and the sun is blowing itself up in one obliging burst. I'm here to take you to the spaceport of Rosary."
"That Sodom!" The worthy woman glowered and shuddered disdainfully at his suggestion.
"We thank you for your warning, but we have no wish to leave our cloister for the rude world. We must go about our morning meditation, which has been interrupted."
"It will be permanently interrupted when that sun starts broiling. You must come now," Jenin said firmly.
"Madam," said Helva, realizing that perhaps a female voice might carry more weight in this instance than Jenin's very masculine charm.
"Who spoke?"
cried the nun, startled by the bodiless voice. "I, Helva the ship. Under my protection, you and your sisters in faith may enter safely and be unprofaned by association with a male. I will guard you and take you safely to a place prepared for you." The matriarch peered cautiously into the ship's open port. "Since only Central Worlds is permitted the use of such ships, I acknowledge that you are not trifling with us, young man. However, we are in no danger here."
"The temperature at Rosary is now 99 degrees, said Helva. "As soon as the sun's rays penetrate directly into this valley, it will also be 99 degrees. And it is due to climb to approximately 180 degrees today. I notice your buildings are made of wood with moss chinking, dry moss. It should fire around noontime."
The sunlight was beginning to slant into the valley through the peaks, and the fierce rays warmed the restless group behind the matriarch. Several opened the throats of their furry parkas. "Jenin," said Helva privately to him, "our time is very short."
"I can't leave them, Helva. Some of those girls are barely out of their teens.
Pretty, too. No wonder the matriarch doesn't want to get in."
"Helva?"
"It will be the Lord's will," said the matriarch stoutly, and turned her back squarely on rescue.
"To burn to death?" shouted Jenin, as she threaded her way through her murmuring disciples.
"They want to be martyrs?"
"They're opt, Jenin," said Helva dispassionately. "We must leave, and that is no longer a matter of option."
"How can I leave, Helva?"
"Parcia,
Helva flung tauntingly at him as he stepped forward to grab one of the women. "You can't drag them all aboard, and we don't have time to fight it out. Get on board, Jennin, or I'll have you on report."
"They'll die," muttered Jennin dejectedly as he reluctantly turned to climb on board.
"You can risk only so much," Helva said sympathetically. "As it is, we'll just have time to make a rendezvous. Lab reports a critical speed-up in spectral evolution." Jennin was already in the airlock when one of the younger women, screaming, rushed to squeeze in the closing port. Her action set off the others, and they stampeded through the narrow opening. Even crammed back to breast, there was not enough room inside. Jennin broke out spacesuits for the three who would have to remain with him in the airlock. He wasted valuable time explaining to the matriarch that she must put on the suit, because the airlock had no independent oxygen or cooling units. "We'll be caught," said Helva grimly to Jennin on their private connection. "We've lost 18 minutes in this last-minute rush. I am now overloaded for maximum speed, and I must attain maximum speed to outrun the heat wave."
"Can you lift? We're suited."
"Lift? Yes," she said, doing so. "Run? I stagger." Jennin, bracing himself and the women, could feel her sluggishness as she blasted upward. Heartlessly, Helva applied thrust as long as she could, despite the fact the gravitational force mashed her cabin passengers brutally and crushed two fatally. It was a question of saving as many as possible. The only one for whom she had any concern was Jennin, and she was in desperate terror about his safety. Airless and uncooled, protected only by one layer of metal, not three, the airlock was not going to be safe for the four trapped there, despite their spacesuits. These were only the standard models, not built to withstand the excessive heat to which the ship would be subjected. Helva ran as fast as she could, but the incredible wave of heat from the explosive sun caught them halfway to cold safety. She paid no heed to the cries, moans, pleas, and prayers in her cabin. She listened only to Jennin's tortured breathing, to the missing throb in his spacesuit's purifying system, and the sucking of the overloaded cooling unit. Helpless, she heard the hysterical screams of his three companions as they writhed in the awful heat. Vainly, Jennin tried to calm them, tried to explain they would soon be safe and cool if they could be still and endure the heat. Undisciplined by their terror and torment, they tried to strike out at him despite the close quarters. One flailing arm became entangled in the leads to his power pack, and the damage was quickly done. A connection, weakened by heat and the dead weight of the arm, broke. For all the power at her disposal, Helva was helpless. She watched as Jennin fought for his breath, as he turned his head beseechingly toward her, and died. Only the iron conditioning of her training prevented Helva from swinging around and plunging back into the exploding sun. Numbly, she made rendezvous with the refugee convoy. She obediently transferred her burned, heat-prostrated passengers to the assigned transport. "I will retain the body of my scout and proceed to the nearest base for burial," she informed Central dully.
"You will be provided escort," was the reply.
"I have no need of escort," she demurred.
"Escort is provided, XH-834, she was told curtly.
The shock of hearing Jennin's initials severed from her call number cut off her half-formed protest. Stunned, she waited by the transport until her screens showed the arrival of two other slim brain ships. The cortege proceeded homeward at unfunereal speeds.
834, the ship who sings.
I have no more songs.
Your scout was Jennin.
I do not wish to communicate.
I'm 422.
Sylvia?
Sylvia died a long time ago. I'm 422. Currently, MS. The ship rejoined curtly. AH-640 is our other friend, but Henry's not listening in. Just as well. He wouldn't understand it if you wanted to turn rogue. But I'd stop him if he tried to delay you.
Rogue?
The term snapped Helva out of her apathy. Sure, you're young. You've got power for years. Skip. Others have done it. 732 went rogue 2 years ago, after she lost her scout on a mission to that white dwarf. Hasn't been seen since.
I never heard about rogues, gasped Helva. as it's exactly the thing we're conditioned against. You sure wouldn't hear about it in school, my dear, 422 said.
Break conditioning? Cried Helva, anguished, thinking of the white, white, furious, hot heart of the sun she had just left.
For you, I don't think it would be hard at the moment, 422 said quietly, her voice devoid of her earlier cynicism.
The stars are out there, winking.
Alone? Cried Helva from her heart.
Alone,
422 confirmed bleakly.
Alone with all of space and time. Even the horsehead nebulae would not be far enough away to daunt her. Alone with 100 years to live with her memories and nothing, nothing more.
Was Parcia worth it? She asked 422 softly.
Parcia?
422 came back surprised.
With his father?
Yes. We were there at Parcia when we were needed, just as you and his son were at Chloe when you were needed. The crime is always not knowing where need is and not being there.
But I need him. Who will supply my need? Said Helva bitterly.
8:34, said 422 after a day's silent speeding. Central wishes your report. A replacement awaits your opt at Regulus Base. Change course accordingly.
A replacement? That was certainly not what she needed. A reminder, inadequately filling the void Jenin left. Why, her hull was barely cool of Chloe's heat. Atavistically, Helva wanted time to mourn Jenin.
Oh, none of them are impossible if you're a good ship, 422 remarked philosophically. And it is just what you need. The sooner the better.
You told them I wouldn't go rogue, didn't you?
Helva said heavily.
The moment passed you even as it passed me after Parcia, and before that, after Glen Arthur and Beetlejuice.
We're conditioned to go on, aren't we?
We can't go rogue.
You were testing.
Had to. Orders. Not even Psycho knows why a rogue occurs.
Central's very worried, and so, daughter, are your sister ships. I asked to be your escort. I don't want to lose you both.
In her emotional nadir, Helva could feel a flood of gratitude for Sylvia's rough sympathy.
We've all known this grief, Helva. It's no consolation, but if we couldn't feel with our scouts, we'd only be machines wired for sound.
Helva looked at Jenin's still form, stretched before her in its shroud, and heard the echo of his rich voice in the quiet cabin.
Sylvia?
I couldn't help him!
She cried from her soul.
Yes, dear. I know.
422 murmured gently, and then was quiet.
The three ships sped on wordless to the great central world's base at Regulus.
Helva broke silence to acknowledge landing instructions and the officially tendered regrets. The three ships set down simultaneously at the wooded edge where Regulus's gigantic blue trees stood sentinel over the sleeping dead in the small service cemetery. The entire base complement approached with measured step and formed an aisle from Helva to the burial ground. The honor detail, out of step, walked slowly into her cabin. Reverently they placed the body of her dead love on the wheeled bier, covered it honorably with the deep blue star-splashed flag of the service. She watched as it was driven slowly down the living aisle, which closed in behind the bier in last escort. Then, as the simple words of interment were spoken, as the atmosphere planes dipped wings in tribute over the open grave, Helva found voice for her lonely farewell. Softly, barely audible at first, the strains of the ancient song of evening and requiem swelled to the final poignant measure until black space itself echoed back the sound of the song the ship sang.